You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody. This is Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially on the couch here on LA Talk Radio, as you always are, Tuesdays, 12 noon Pacific Standard Time, and wherever you are around. I have an amazing guest for you today, and we're going to be talking about her latest book. And first of all, let me welcome her. Hi there, Dr. Margaret Chisholm. How are you?
Hi, I'm delighted to be on the couch. Thank you.
So nice to have you here. And, you know, we're going to be talking about her latest book. It as I decided, and I told you earlier, Meg, what I'm going to do is use this as a great book for my patients. It's called From Survive to Thrive, Living Your Best Life with Mental Illness. And I'm telling you, it is a great read, and it will help you all out. And you don't have to have a mental illness in order to really gain something from this book. That's what I found most helpful. So thank you so much for being on the show and for being here and to talk about the book today. It was a great read.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, of course, we've been dealing with the pandemic, everyone here, and talking about all of the problems with not necessarily even mental illness, but mental issues that most of us are experiencing, from social isolation and the financial issues going on. And just I think there's a general malaise, you know, of feeling people just go out and it's heavy. We're all masked up and there's just a lot of things, you know, just going on. Isolation is huge as well. So, but it has gotten worse even before, you know, the pandemic. It says that 2020 survey said that double the pre-pandemic rates of anxiety or depression, you know, have started happening. So, I mean, there's increased substance abuse, stress-related symptoms, you know, going on. So today, Dr. Chisholm's going to help you out how to handle this and buy and downplay the stigma of mental illness. And I'm totally in agreement with you on that as well. So let's talk about your book and some of the key points in it, just to get started here. I also want to, you know, just let you know, you are the vice chair for education, psychiatry, and behavioral sciences. And you're a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Amazing accolades. She directs the Paul McHugh Program for Human Flourishing, which also fosters a humanistic clinical approach to patient care. All right. So amazing. And you are going to help a lot of people today. So I'd like to just start off on a positive note, because you bring a positive thing. What is to those people struggling with mental illness or mental issues in general who feel defeated and believe that life will not improve for them?
Yeah, so, you know, the term mental illness is a tricky one, and I'm not using that to mean a psychiatric disease or anything like that. I see these psychiatric problems as anytime there's a problem with your feelings or your thoughts or your behaviors. And so I would put all that under this big umbrella of mental illness, but it doesn't mean that you have a disease. And as you said, Michelle, the pandemic has just affected everyone, and it's affected their sense of well-being. And your mental health is part of your well-being, right?
Oh my goodness, yes. The mind-body connection is so strong.
Yeah. And so if you think about, you know, what it is when you lead a good life, what are those aspects of a good life that are important to you? It's happiness, it's life satisfaction, it's having a healthy body and a healthy mind. It's having a sense of meaning and purpose. And all those things have been disrupted by the pandemic, but that doesn't mean that you can't make, you know, the most of a bad situation. And that's sort of a theme of the book, right? That even if you have psychiatric problems, you know, when life happens, right? The pandemic happened. We weren't expecting it. Here it is. And how do we navigate that? How do we negotiate that and not let it have more power over us than it needs to have?
Boy, is that true? You nailed it. You also suggest in your book that successful treatment considers the whole person. And can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I trained at Johns Hopkins in the late 80s, yeah. early 90s. I've been on the faculty there for about 30 years.
Wow.
And, you know, we have an approach to thinking about people that's very holistic. So mm-hmm. we,
yes.
with every patient that I see, that any of us see who've trained at Hopkins, we really look at somebody from multiple perspectives, multiple mm-hmm. angles. Mm-hmm. And we want to understand the problems that they bring to us and try to figure out the origin of those problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they diseases that have just come
right.
up on somebody? Is it a problem related to who one is as a person? You know, your personality.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a problem related to something you're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it,
yeah.
and or is it a problem in how you're making sense of what's happened in your life, how you're dealing
yes.
with things?
Mm-hmm.
So all those aspects of a person are relevant to understanding the psychiatric problems and how best to approach them and remedy them.
Beautiful. You and I both agree to downplay the idea of the DSM-5 and the ICD-10's definitions of mental illness, because it really does compartmentalize people into certain categories, which to me requires so much testing, so much analysis, and still everyone's different. So how do you feel about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The DSM is a tool.
Mm-hmm.
it has some merits. It can help researchers certainly who are to make mm-hmm. sure that they're studying something that looks similar, a disease, for instance, that looks similar.
Yeah.
But it's a real problem in that it is a bunch of labels, right? And it's a bunch
right.
of categories.
Yeah.
And that really, even though it wasn't designed to be listing diseases,
sure.
people have come to think mm-hmm. that almost everything that's in the DSM is a disease
mm-hmm.
and a disease that requires, you know, one treatment like medication.
Mm-hmm.
So it just is a very narrow way, I think, of understanding psychiatric problems. And
yeah.
it has become so easy to be able mm-hmm. to give somebody, you know, go through the checklist of mm-hmm. signs and symptoms and say, that's what you have.
Sure.
And ended at that. So I just think it's one sliver of,
yeah.
of information. It's one tool, but it's certainly not sufficient to treat people who are much more complicated
mm-hmm.
than anything.
I hear you.
Can be captured no. by that.
Exactly. In your book, From Survive to Thrive, Living Your Best Life with Mental Illness, you divine a flourishing, thriving, you know, how would you just define that? You know,
yeah. So, you know, this is not me. It's, you know, thousands
yeah.
of years of philosophers thinking about what makes a good mm-hmm. life. And I alluded to some of those domains
mm-hmm.
earlier,
mm-hmm.
Happiness, life satisfaction,
yeah.
physical and mental health, mm-hmm. meaning and purpose,
mm-hmm.
character
yes.
and virtue.
Right.
And also, you know, people want to have some obviously financial or material security and close social relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about that as leading a good life, you can do that
sure.
with any kind of psychiatric problems.
Mm.
Even people with severe schizophrenia who
yes.
aren't having any symptom relief,
mm-hmm.
aren't having any functional relief,
right.
can
mm-hmm.
still have personal recovery where they feel
mm-hmm.
Valued
mm-hmm.
and inherently valuable as a person, as well as having a sense of meaning and purpose. So all that's within your reach, regardless of whether or not you're struggling with a mental illness.
You know, I totally agree with that. I worked in a couple of hospitals here in Los Angeles and in psychiatric clinics, and it's true. It really is. With the right help, the right therapeutic techniques, and of course, medication. I really do believe in certain types of medication to really help specific disorders. But also with the important information in your book, I think a lot of people can really help flourish or get better. So I'd like to get into that in just a little bit, but I always like to find out a little bit more about my guests. And I know that you went through some hardships as well on your own. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, sure. I mean, yeah. one of the storylines in the book is actually mm-hmm. my story. I use my mm-hmm. story to help people understand some of the concepts in the book, but also yeah. as a way of really practicing what I preach, which is the mm-hmm. importance of destigmatization of psychiatric illness. I had a depression in my college years. I had a suicide attempt and then was very healthy mm-hmm. until after my child was born. I have one child. And mm-hmm. after he, I had a postpartum depression that required mm-hmm. treatment with medication. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, these are treatable illnesses. Yes. I got better. And I also have a brother or had a brother who killed himself. He took his own mm-hmm. life in 2012. Oh. And so I write about his mm-hmm. Illness as well.
Sure you do. I'm so sorry that you've dealt with all this, but you know, everyone has something, right? As you exactly. say in your book, you know, at the beginning, you say something like, if you're flourishing and your life's perfect, and maybe it's not.
Not too many.
Can even help, right? Not too many folks are like that. So we all have stuff. We all have yeah. past. We all have trauma, truly, no matter how, you know, we define that. But, you know, I really think that it's lovely to be able to find out, especially from your personal stories and some of your case stories that you discuss, that you kind of roll out in your book, the conversations you have with some patients and some of the questions that you ask them to think or ask them about to really review who they are, what their life is about. I love that part of the book. And I think readers love to find out about personal stories as well. So that's
thank
terrific.
You. Yeah. I mean, the idea was to have it be very engaging so mm-hmm. that it was conversational in tone. I actually cool. just listened to the audiobook and really liked
cool.
like I didn't read the audiobook.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It was fun. It was fun for me to listen to it. Yeah. You know, with it was just a whole nother experience from
Oh, that's neat.
It.
That is great, isn't it? It really is, especially when we have a great voiceover person doing the reading of our book. So and we'll talk about how viewers and listeners can go ahead and get a hold of that audiobook as well as the hard copy if they'd like. So let's get a little bit into the four steps or lenses, as you call them, that mental health professionals try and understand what's really causing somebody's depression or anxiety or even bipolar disorder.
Yeah, so that was the, you know, this idea of how we're trained at Hopkins is through the, mm-hmm. is to look at a patient from these four mm-hmm. perspectives. Mm-hmm. And basically the idea is that in the rest of medicine, most explanations for problems, physical problems that we'll have, it's really there's a broken part mm-hmm. in the body or a broken function in the body that's causing mm-hmm. this syndrome, these signs and mm-hmm. symptoms. Mm-hmm. And yeah. so that's one perspective mm-hmm. is this right. disease perspective. You know, this is common with people with schizophrenia, for instance, or mania. This is a clear-cut disease. This has come upon somebody unbidden. It's very stereotypic. It looks the same mm-hmm. around the world. You know, people's lives can be in a shambles and they are feeling on top of the world. There's just a disconnect from reality, right?
Sure.
So those are examples of disease.
Right.
Diseases. But then there's other psychiatric problems that people bring to us that really don't fit that kind mm-hmm. of a model.
Mm-hmm.
And so they need to be understood or explained using looking at the person from perspective. Is part of who they are as a person. You know, is it your personality? Right. Are you somebody who's very intense? Or do you mm-hmm. respond really strongly emotionally to events in your life? Do you are you somebody who's extremely conscientious and that can cause problems? And the idea of this dimensional perspective, we call mm-hmm. it, is mm-hmm. that it's not like there's a good or bad personality. It's just in
right.
certain situations, your
right.
personality is working for you, and in others, it's working against you. So, you know, if you're somebody who's very, you know, you think you dwell on the past or the future rather than being in the moment, you know, mm-hmm. being in sales might not be the best job for you.
Right.
Right. You've got to make 100 cold calls and you might get 99 or more rejections mm-hmm. and you've got to go back to it. And as somebody who has that kind of personality, who's dwelling on the past, is not going to be able, and worried about the future, is not going to be able mm-hmm. to do really feel very comfortable in sales. It's not a
right.
good fit.
Right. So, exactly.
So somebody could have problems yeah. because of who they are as a person, their personality.
Sure.
And the not being a right fit for the situation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's two perspectives, disease mm-hmm. sure. and dimensional, mm-hmm. the personality. Sure. Yeah. And then the other two perspectives are the behavior perspective and the life story perspective. So the behavior perspective is really asks us to think, how much of this person's problem is, or problems are mm-hmm. because of something that they're doing? Mm-hmm. Are they restricting their food intake in order to,
okay.
you know, because mm-hmm. of a fear of being sure. overweight? Mm-hmm. Are they using substances? Mm-hmm. Those are examples. Yeah, maybe Bison's use disorder, but it's inherently different. It's qualitatively different from mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. disease of schizophrenia, because there is, as anybody who's gone to AA yeah. or NA can tell yeah, you, there's sure. a, there is a little bit of choice involved.
Yes.
Even though with, you know, abuse and yeah. conditioned learning, that choice becomes very narrow and very difficult to
sure.
Deviate from. There's still Boy, something a little different than a disease. And it needs to be yeah. treated differently. It's not just a pill that's going to sure. solve addiction. It's not a pill that's going to solve an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
No. And then the fourth perspective is the life story perspective. And mm-hmm. that is mm-hmm. an example of that is grief.
Sure.
This is an event that's happened to you and mm-hmm. You know, you are responding in a certain way mm-hmm. to that event. You're dealing with it in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see interrelate, right? You can have mm-hmm. a disease
sure,
and you can deal with that in a way mm-hmm. that might be more or less adaptive. Mm-hmm. You can have a disease and on the basis of your personality mm-hmm. react to mm-hmm. it more strongly than somebody else mm-hmm. who has that same event. So there's a lot of interaction mm-hmm. between these perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you so much for rolling that out for us. I think a lot of people just learned some information as to how clinicians, psychiatrists and therapists really, you know, kind of break down what's going on with individuals. By the way, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with me, Michelle Cohen, and my special guest, Dr. Meg Chisholm. And she is the Vice Chair for Education, Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, and a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. And we're talking about her latest book. It's called From Survive to Thrive, Living Your Best Life with Mental Illness. And again, it's pretty much for everybody out there, because we all have stuff, you know, growing up, whether we are, you know, born with an inherited, perhaps, disease, or, you know, and you were just talking about, Meg, the behavioral perspective, what's going on with that, personal issues, and also the backstory or the life story of individuals. I was wondering something, you know, we were talking about behavioral traits and also personalities. The DSM-5 mm-hmm. and prior editions talk about what we call Axis II mental disorders, personality disorders, so as to speak. Can we change our personalities at all? Or how does that work?
Well, I have a lot to say about these personality disorders. The fact that they were called Axis II meant there was something special about them.
Yes.
And what was special is that they couldn't really, many of them couldn't be distinguished from
right.
the others. So that's why right. they were put into Axis II, and they're in clusters, cluster A, B, and C. That means, you know, that somebody who is diagnosed with borderline personality disorder or histrionic personality disorder or narcissistic personality disorder mm-hmm. can't really be distinguished from somebody else. One person might say that they have borderline personality disorder. Another person might say they have histrionic. They're not distinguishable.
Right.
So we really say that that's sophisticated name calling
right.
At Hopkins. So we don't really use diagnoses. Because if they're not reliable, and we don't know about any psychiatric disorders being, you know, necessarily valid based on these checklists, we're not going to use them. So instead, we think about people as having various potentials. You know, what's your potential for reacting strongly? What's your potential for being present-oriented? What's your potential for being open? And we look at people's potential, and then we think about what provokes them to respond in a way that's negative in terms of thoughts or behaviors. Your personality is your personality is your personality. It's not going to shift a lot in life, okay? but that doesn't mean that your thoughts and your behaviors might not shift, because personalities are really about affective temperament. That's your that's affective. That's how you're going to feel in a certain situation. That doesn't mean, so I might get very, I might have road rage. And so I might, whenever I'm in a traffic jam, get really angry. But that doesn't mean I have to behave in a way that that is out of control, even though my feeling might be strong. And it doesn't mean that I have to think really negatively. So you have, you don't have a lot of control over the natural feelings that arise. That is part of your temperament. It doesn't change, but you do have control over what you think in response to those feelings and how you act in response to those feelings. And that's what, you know, the book is trying to help people with, is understand themselves so that they can have take more control over their lives, have more agency in their lives.
Exactly. And I love your take on the personality disorders. I really do, because it is not fair to pigeonhole folks. And, you know, it seems in social media and popular psychology, you know, there's a lot of finger pointing, oh, she's bipolar, or, you know, or, well, the personality disorders, oh, he's a narcissist, or, well, there are possible characteristics that might point to someone and has an ego issue or whatever. But I mean, you really, I agree, you can't really define.
You can't distinguish a narcissist from a sociopath. So I'm just saying. And one carries a lot more negative connotation.
That's really true. You know, so it's really understanding and trying to sort of sort that out and help people. And like you said, you can't really change a core being personality per se, but you can change your behavior. And you know, what I love about your book as well is you talk about, I mean, there are certain, you know, self insight tools that you use in some of those sessions that you share in the book, which are fascinating, which also involve cognitive behavioral tools. But I love your humanistic approach. So that's very effective as well. And how do you think your particular humanistic approach in your work helps patients?
Well, you know, I think that the basis of a successful psychotherapy is really the relationship between the clinician and the person seeking treatment. And, you know, I think that really what you actually do in therapy doesn't matter as much as that relationship. And so treating somebody with respect, with dignity, with curiosity about them, not giving advice or trying to live their life, but helping them understand themselves, taking a real interest in that, being hopeful. All those things, I think, are what make for a successful psychotherapy. So that's what I see as a humanistic approach, is looking at somebody as a whole person. More than just a disease label, more than just a personality label, more than the catalog of what they've experienced in their life. Or what they've done, but really trying to connect with them as a human, one human to another.
Oh, that's beautiful. I, you know, I really love that. And I think that is, I really agree with you. It's so important to do that. Sometimes we, say me, our colleagues sometimes are a little hesitant to to be a little more transparent, and they're presenting a sense of authority over people sometimes. So I think it's really important to, you know, really.
It's definitely about trust. You're going to, I mean, you know, I was taught by Jerome Frank, who wrote this wonderful book, Persuasion and Healing. And he was my psychotherapy supervisor for a year. And, you know, the book Persuasion and Healing really sums it up. That's what psychotherapy is.
Yes.
You're persuading somebody towards healing.
Yes.
You know, you can persuade somebody towards nefarious things too, but no, you're persuading somebody towards healing. And, you know, who are you persuaded by? You're persuaded by people you respect and who respect you, right?
Exactly. No, it makes sense.
It's all about the relationship.
You know, it really is. It's so important. And that is the humanistic, you know, perspective. So there are the big five qualities that shape our personality. Can you just get into those just a little more? The big five.
Yeah. I've alluded to some of those too.
Yes,
so the big five are it goes by the acronym NEOPI, Neo Personality Inventory. So that starts us off with three of them: neuroticism, extroversion, openness. And then the other two are agreeableness and conscientiousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think of each of those as a spectrum, and everybody is some point on that spectrum from high neuroticism to low neuroticism. And by neuroticism, I really mean somebody who feels things really strongly, who, you know, sometimes that has been given a negative connotation being neurotic, but it's not inherently negative.
Yes.
Somebody who's neurotic is not going to neglect, you know, a cancerous mole.
Right.
And so in that case, being neurotic really served you well.
Yes.
So it's all about the fit between your personality and the particular situation. So neuroticism, extroversion, it's really, I define that mostly as how future or past oriented somebody is. If they're very future or past oriented, they're more introverted. If they're very present oriented, they're more extroverted. A lot of people think about extroversion as being sort of energized by being around people. But if you think about why you're energized being around people, it's because you're a present oriented person. Because if you are a past or future oriented person, you're going to be drained by being around people because you're going to be worrying about what you just said and what you're about to do. So it's, I think at its core, it's more past future orientation versus present orientation.
Fascinating.
And then another spectrum is openness. People who, you know, are open to new experiences, abstract thoughts, versus somebody who tends to be more literal minded, concrete. That's, you know, not, again, not a negative or positive thing.
No.
You can be too open, right?
Sure.
You can
sure.
want to try every drug on the planet or, you know, get into kind of weird ideas or so, you know, it's it's all, it's not a good or bad. In certain situations, being open is good. In others, it's not so good. And then agreeableness is the fourth one. And that really is, what it sounds like, you know, are you somebody who, you know, are you purely rigid and inflexible and kind of, I don't know what the word is, grumpy or kind of person. And again, in some situations, it's good not to be too agreeable.
Sure.
You know, you'll get walked all over if you're too agreeable. But, you know, on the extreme, there's, you know, the disciple person. And then conscientiousness. And that really is, you know, do you hold things as really important? Like if you take a vow, is that really important to you?
Yes,
if you say you're going to pick up your socks, do you do it? A lot of relationship problems come around because because of a mismatch in conscientiousness.
So
those are the big five, and everybody is someplace on every one of those. It doesn't change much. I've had the Neo PI done on me twice, 30 years apart, didn't change a bit.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
A bit.
So it's pretty stable.
It's very stable.
Wow. That is very super. That
doesn't mean I'm stable. It just means the test is stable.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Absolutely. But no, that's really fascinating. I also love as well and here live that there's no judgment. No. I mean, you can't really, you don't live in other people's shoes. You haven't lived their consciousness. You haven't lived their experiences. You know, we have our own, I guess to say corny words, truth. We have our own perceptions and our own biological things that are going on. We have our own environment, early environment, messages we receive from the past, you know, things that are happening in the here and now and how we've learned from them or not, you know. So there, it's really a good thing. And not only, you know, for people in our industry, but for individuals in general, not to try and judge others.
Yeah, have, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Right?
You never know until you walk in somebody's shoes.
Yeah.
There's no judgment.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about breaking bad habits, or building good ones. Can you elaborate a little bit more on how we can work on creating better habits for ourselves? Maybe?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I tell my own story because I lost like 65 pounds or something.
My gosh.
So wow. I had a very bad habit.
Is that
a
good thing? Is that
yeah,
a bad
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, yeah, okay. I ate a lot. So that was my bad habit.
Okay.
I like to cook and things like that. So, but yeah. You know, it's really about understanding how habits develop, how you get set in certain behavior patterns.
Yeah.
And a lot of this has to do with, I think, goals and commitment. Unfortunately, you know, you have to really commit yourself and be ready to change a habit.
Sure. Sure.
I often say that, you know, nobody changes their behaviors until it's more uncomfortable to remain the same.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes more uncomfortable to remain the same. That's when people start changing. And that was my story. You know, it was more uncomfortable to not lose the weight. So I decided I made a commitment to lose weight. And I think this is what people who have substance use disorders know. You know, they have to be ready to change. They have to be ready to make a commitment. And you can't, as much as we'd like to help other people change, ultimately they have to be ready and make a commitment. So to break a bad habit or to start a new habit, you really, you know, have to first have that commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a while to make any behavior change become a habit, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And we all know this, right? If we take a break from working out every day, it's going to take a while to get back into that habit again.
Sure.
But once you're in the habit of doing something, whether it's good or bad, it becomes more difficult to stop engaging in that behavior without an interruption. So
right, exactly. Now that makes a lot of sense. It really does. I think what's interesting, you know, just mentioned people who have substance abuse issues, and there's so many dynamics to that. But I think a lot of people tend to ignore what other people are saying around them, and you can't force anyone, you know, with substance abuse and of course other diseases, you know, that go along with that, depression, anxiety, whatever. It's really important to encourage people to listen to what others are saying, and the consensus of the majority, as we say. Why is it so difficult, do you think, for people to not be able to listen and really take in what other people are saying to them? Like, I'm so worried about you. And, you know, whether it's family or, you know, relationships, best friends, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, I'll just say this. I think I'm addiction medicine certified, so I could go into great detail about this. But, you know, we have innate drives for food, for sex, for sleep. These are innate drives for behaviors that are really hardwired in us, in our brain circuitry, so that we survive eating, sleeping, and so that the species survives sex. And so that's our neurocircuitry,
right,
has evolved mm-hmm. to perpetuate us in the species.
Sure. Right.
So what happens with addiction, drives develop that aren't innate. You know, somebody is exposed to heroin, for instance, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. alcohol, and one person may take it and have a negative experience or couldn't care less about it. Another person, it might have a real powerful effect on them mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
in terms of, you know, what they get out of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then they go back for more. It becomes a drive right. like food, like mm-hmm. sex, like mm-hmm. sleep. Mm-hmm. It becomes conditioned. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it would be very difficult, I think, for me to try to talk you out of sleeping or talk mm-hmm. you out of eating,
right.
you know, because it becomes such a powerful drive.
Mm-hmm. It really
and that's,
does.
That, yeah. The drive for alcohol or mm-hmm. drugs mm-hmm. is that power,
right.
buddy. Even in the face of all kinds of negative consequences, mm-hmm. but you know, negative consequences do not result in behavior change generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I had a patient that mm-hmm. had somebody I took care of on the inpatient unit who had lost his job, his wife, mm-hmm. I mean, he'd actually killed his wife through an automobile accident. So
oh,
lost
my
his
God.
Job. His wife
oh, my goodness.
Was in liver failure, oh. so he'd lost his health. I mean, he'd lost everything
right.
to his alcohol use. And I said, would you consider going to AA? Well, it's not that bad. I'm like, well, okay. This person is not ready to change.
Right.
I'm not going to judge them.
No.
But I'm just going to say it's, you know, all I want to do is build a relationship with that person so that they're ready to change,
yeah.
to change. I'm there for them. That's
yes.
all you do. And it's a very helpless feeling, you know, when you see someone with addiction
sure
to not
is.
Be able to
yes.
help them become more ready to change. All you can do is work on yourself, as people
no.
who've been to Al-Anon will know.
Oh, that's so true. It's
but
really
people
true.
Do change when they're ready. When they're ready.
yeah, that's right. I guess we all do when we're ready. And thank you, by the way, for sharing your personal story. I really, personally, just a little transparency. I love to eat. You know, it's one of my hobbies. You know, listed in the little information you fill out with things. Hobbies. Enjoying good food.
Yes.
And I wouldn't say cooking so well, but not that great of a cook, but I love sweets. I love, you know, eating, and it's also a comforting thing. But until I really forced myself to start reading about some of the things I was eating and read the information about nutritional foods and what they really are doing for your body, and saw some issues coming up with my cardiologist, I said, that scared me so much. So I guess,
right.
Unlike your patient you just talked about, we have to be scared, maybe, or even that doesn't even work sometimes. We're not even ready until we're ready, whatever that is, whatever that means. But the trust that you, you know, really can invoke in other people is important. So, yeah, as a clinician. So, in case you just tuned in, everybody, you're on the couch here, and we're talking with Dr. Margaret Chisholm, and she has an amazing book out now. I'm going to be giving Living Your Best Life with Mental Illness. And you don't even have to have a mental illness. I think we all have things, as I mentioned at the top of the show, in our background. We are all trying to survive and thrive to a certain extent. And it's always a journey, isn't it? We're always learning, right, Mark? Isn't that
I'm
true?
Certainly always learning every
yeah.
day.
Yes.
And, you know, and the thing about this, you know, surviving with a mental illness and thriving with a mental illness
mm-hmm.
is that sometimes the mental illness, it's not despite your mental illness that you thrive,
right.
it's because of your mental illness
mm-hmm.
that you thrive. Think of
mm-hmm.
the people who've gotten with addiction, who've gotten into the recovery work and become
uh-huh.
much more fulfilled people than they were before they started using.
Mm-hmm.
Or people who have developed a serious mental illness like schizophrenia, who then mm-hmm. find meaning and purpose in helping other people
yes.
recover. Mm-hmm. So sometimes our illnesses actually can help us thrive. Mm-hmm. Yes. So it's not necessarily despite a mental illness that you thrive, but because of it.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. And that also helps answer the question that many of your patients and probably some of the people I work with, why me? Why was I born? Why, when I turned 18, did I all of a sudden start having changes in my brain, or 19 or 20, you know, a typical age where they find that changes are happening with severe mental illnesses coming on. So yeah. It's, well, that's it. It's maybe you're learning now. Maybe you can learn how to survive and thrive from this with the help of medical doctors such as yourself and good therapists like you.
Yeah, I think everyone wants to make meaning of their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And everybody has hopes and dreams. Mm-hmm. And, you know, life sometimes gets in the way of those. There are random mm-hmm. acts of tragedy. There are mm-hmm. diseases that happen. Mm-hmm. And trying to make sense of those and still, you know, remain really fulfilled in your life is a challenge mm-hmm. because it's a loss that people have to work through, right? Mm-hmm. And people come to therapy, I think, mm-hmm. because their life's not where they want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bottom line, it can be because right. of a disease, it can be because of who they are as a person, it can
mm-hmm.
be
mm-hmm.
because of something they're doing or something that's happened to them. But the common mm-hmm. denominator, I think, is your life's not where you want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, well, sometimes mm-hmm. getting it to where you want it to be means kind of readjusting your expectations,
right,
and finding meaning with right. whatever life you're given.
That is, I think, the crux of everything is finding meaning in your life. What can you give, and what are you learning? How can you make your life richer? Not literally, but, well, maybe that too, I guess. But I mean, you know, how can you become happier and feel more fulfilled in your life, you know,
yeah.
that's the thing. And that's the key. So we feel sometimes defeated, a lot of people, especially those who come to see us, you know, and they're down and out, as some of the people you've talked about in your book. What would you tell them, especially during this time, during COVID, when a lot of issues are coming up for us, life is going to improve. How would you relay to them that things can improve?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this because, you know, I had been doing work with this flourishing model, looking at these domains of flourishing. Okay. And then there's these pathways to flourishing that have been mm-hmm. identified. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, this is from large epidemiologic, you know, data yeah. sets that have shown that the four pathways to flourishing are family, work, education, and community.
Yes.
And if you think of the pandemic, think of how it's interfered with family, work, education, community. It's yep. hit all of those. So it's no yep. surprise that we're not flourishing. It's right. affected our Ooh. Happiness, our life satisfaction,
right.
our mental health, our physical health, mm-hmm. our meaning and purpose. You know, it's been devastating.
It has.
And so thinking about how, even during the pandemic, mm-hmm. you can support your connections along those pathways.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, how can you, thank goodness for Zoom, right? How can
oh my
you
gosh.
Reconnect with family? How can you engage in meaningful work?
Mm-hmm.
How can you learn either through
yeah.
formal education or, you know, informal
right learning? Yes.
And how can you, during the pandemic, still maintain a sense of community? It may be getting right. involved with a new community if your old
yes.
community was always at the gym or someplace where you
right.
go.
right.
But there are ways, if you think about those four pathways, family, work, education, and community,
mm-hmm.
There are ways to strengthen those even during the pandemic.
You know, they really are. And what a marvelous tool Google is, because you can find in your area certain groups of interest. You know, we used to have meetups before the pandemic. You get into certain hobbies or groups with individuals. And, well, we have virtual meetups, which is not as quite as warm and fuzzy. But, I mean, it really, they are ways that you can network and feel a little bit more fulfilled that you are connecting with other people. And I always say, despite the fear of going out in public, make sure everybody keeps up with their medical visits.
Yeah, really important.
Mm-hmm. I see a lot of people tapering off on there. Well, I don't want to go out and I don't want to go to this doctor or that doctor, but that's very important as well to make sure you're masking up, taking care of yourself. And, you know, don't miss things like that. And certainly, you know, this does give us a little rest to be able to read the books we wanted to read, you know.
Well, you know, you're doing what you need to do, which is focus on the gains, right? We, you know, there's two ways to look at every situation. We can focus on the negatives or the positives. What have we lost? We've lost a lot. Right. What have we gained? Well, you know, I've gained some things. Thankfully, I've been able to take walks outside more. I lost the commute, which is been a gain. And just focusing on those, because that's all you can do really in this situation.
I agree. I mean, that's really true. You really have to think about that. In your book, From Survive to Thrive, Living Your Best Life with Mental Illness, you point out a really cool, I call it the airport metaphor, right? And it kind of represents the journey from mental illness to well-being. And so can you just briefly describe what happens during the ticketing, pre-boarding, and departure phases? I love that.
Well, yeah, the book has pictures, so it makes it a little easier.
That's right.
But,
yeah, cool.
But, you know, the idea is that you want to be able to take off and to really live your life fully. And so that's why we use that metaphor. And we're thinking about the start of your journey, the ticketing phase, as when you're kind of just sorting things out, right? You're deciding what's the priority. Do you need to have your disease treated? Do you need medication to become, you know, less severely depressed as a first issue to work on? So as you're sorting that out, that's sort of the ticketing phase. And then once you figure out what needs to be done, you can either do it relatively quickly or sometimes it takes longer. And that's sort of the mezzanine level of the airport where you're kind of, you know, if you're getting over substance use, it might take a little longer than, you know, if you're being treated with a medication that gets you well right away. Mm-hmm. But you're getting ready to take off and you're starting to think about those pathways. You know, if you're somebody who's been experiencing addiction, you might have burned bridges with your family that you need to kind of rebuild. If you might have to replace your drug using, well, I know you're going to have to replace your drug using community with a different community. Mm-hmm. You might want to re-engage with your faith community. You might want to start working on your GED or going back to college or continuing whatever formal education you'd like. And then you might need to actually get a job. Most of us do. And so those are the kinds of things that as you're getting well, will actually help you get well, right? If you get a job, even if you're really depressed, getting a job having a job is a good thing. Sure, having someplace to go.
That's right.
Being activated.
Yes.
So all that is happening at the training level, preparing you to take off. Which we mean flourish.
Exactly. Beautifully said. You know, I love that. And it is. It's just, you know, having a purpose, basically. Finding the purposes, having a purpose, trying to be more social with people and you know, go through the steps in your book, which is terrific. From Survive to Thrive, Living Your Best Life with Mental Illness. And also, if you'd like to pick up the book, of course, it's available on Amazon. What is the best way that viewers and listeners can find out more about you and Dr. Margaret Chisholm?
Well, there is a website that I have for the book. It's margaretchisholmmd.com. So that's sort of one-stop shopping there.
Okay. Beautiful. Thank you so much for being on the couch with me today. Time's already up. I can't believe it.
Oh, my goodness.
Also fast.
That 50-minute hour. Okay.
I know. Yeah. Yeah, there you go. You know about that.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for all of you that you do for everyone else and for sharing this wonderful book. It's going to help out a lot of people.
I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, everybody. That's it. This is Dr. Michelle Cohen, and I appreciate you being on the couch with me today. Until next week. Tuesday, 12 noon Pacific Standard Time. Take care of yourself first, and then you'll be great for others. And that's the way it works. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.